So this is joint work with my thesis advisor, Jamie Sethian, when I was at Berkeley, and also with Len Barucki, who's a scientist at Motorola, who came to visit us at LBL for about 4 months every other week or so. So, and the problem that I'm studying, so this is what's left over after you etch away everything that isn't metal in an interconnect or in a microchip, so the stuff in your computer. These are tiny wires connecting together all of the circuit elements, the transistors, diodes, and so on in your microchip. And these things are so small now that they carry tremendous current densities, something like 2 million amps per square centimeter these days. And at such high current densities, the atoms in the lattice actually get when the electrons flow through these lines, they scatter off of imperfections in the lattice, and it causes the atoms to actually migrate. So what ends up happening is you can get voiding in the circuits. There's a little hole here. Also here, as current is flowing through this thing, it actually transports these atoms out of these locations, and that can cause the circuit to fail. And here's another situation where a void has occurred here, and the material that was there got pushed down the line and sort of pops out further on as an extrusion here. The scales here, typically you're looking at about a micron in diameter for the lines, and the lines run, say, 200 or 300 microns in length. So this is an experiment in which people were trying to study the effects of different alloys of, or basically different materials to find out which ones are best for inhibiting electromigration. But what I wanted to do with this slide is just show that, so as time evolves, this is a small section of that line at the top there. As time evolves, they're looking at this with a TEM microscope and watching the shape of the void that's shown here evolve in time. And you can see in just 4 or 5 hours, it's actually moved several diameters of the line down. And also the shape has changed quite dramatically. And this is 0.6 microns by 3 microns by 300 microns. So the other thing that's going on, as these atoms move, they tend to bunch up at one end of the line, and that causes stresses to form. And the stress gradients also affect the flow of electrons. So not only does electromigration cause the electrons to move, but also gradients in stress affect the diffusion along the grain boundaries and along interfaces. So this was a paper by Blech and Herring from 76 in which they first wrote down what they thought the chemical potential of an atom was in a grain boundary due to this stress. And they're looking at TEM microscopic pictures of actually looking at that stress and seeing what happens as time evolves. So what we're doing, we have a two-dimensional model in which we put down a bunch of grains on an interconnect line. Perhaps we put some voids along the grain boundaries or somewhere in the bulk. We flow current through here, so we solve for the electrostatic potential in the line, and then the current is proportional to the electric field that you get from that. And the grain boundary network is a fast diffusion path for atoms to move, and then in each grain is deforming elastically. And then we'll look at what the normal stress is along the grain boundaries to get the dynamics right. And I'll say what the equations and so on are in a second. So there's a lot of equations here. The main thing is that it's a diffusion process, so it's governed by the Einstein-Nernst equation here that says the flux of atoms is proportional to the gradient of the chemical potential. And then we have several constitutive equations for what the chemical potential looks like at free surfaces, along grain boundaries, and in the bulk. And to include electromigration, you just add, this is a phenomenological effective charge of a vacancy, actually. And let's see, what else do we have? So you just put in this gradient of the electric potential to get the effect of electromigration. And then the result, the one we're going to be, or I'm going to be talking about today, is grain boundary diffusion. So atoms want to move from regions of compressive stress to regions of tension to allow the, or to reduce the elastic energy in the material, and then also they flow by this electromigration force. And then there's also a continuity equation, it's basically just mass conservation. And to emphasize what's going on with that continuity equation, imagine this is a grain boundary between two grains, and atoms are flowing along this grain boundary here. And if there's a net flow into the region that I've shown here, then the extra atoms start incorporating themselves into the lattice on each side. And as this happens, the grains actually start to separate to make room for the new material that's been added there. So if you imagine that you painted this atom here and this atom here, and you watched those two atoms as a function of time, as material accumulates here, you'll find that those atoms actually move apart. And likewise, if material was leaving this region, then they'd move together until they themselves got moved along. So we model this, since we're solving the equations of elasticity on each side of the grain, we model this net grain growth as the jump in displacement across the grain. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. But the idea is this continuity equation is just saying that the amount of grain growth is proportional to the amount of extra atoms that have been deposited in this particular section of the line. Okay, so a lot of people have studied void dynamics without any stresses and also curvature-driven grain boundary motion in the past. So I sort of took the other side, and I'm just studying stresses for now. Let's assume that there aren't any voids in the structure, so we can solve for the electrostatic potential once and for all. I'm basically doing a linearized version of the model. So the grains stay fixed in the reference configuration, and then on each grain I'm going to let the displacement field evolve as a function of time. And as that happens, the jump in displacement is going to determine this net grain growth that has occurred along the line. So this is a definition of G, actually. It says that G is supposed to be the jump in the displacement in the normal direction across the grain boundary here as a function of time. And then, so what I've shown in this picture, imagine that you've taken some atoms and moved them from this side to this side. If you didn't force the grains to line up with each other so that they can actually pass through each other over here and separate over here, so this is sort of the natural state of the grains. And then, but they don't want to actually form these open surfaces. So what will happen is you'll actually zip these things together along the grain boundary so they fit together nicely. And they have to be pushed apart here so that they fit. And what you need along the grain boundary is a balance of tractions or a balance of forces. So these are boundary conditions. These are traction boundary conditions with a specified jump and displacement. And then this is a definition. I'm going to call the normal stress. I'm going to give this function a name, eta. So to try to clarify what's going on here, so this is the function g as a function of time. At the beginning, you'll end up, and so for each of these curves over here, there's some corresponding displacement field, which is given throughout the entire interconnect. This is a very simple geometry. It's just a flat grain boundary in a rectangular interconnect line. And we're running current from this side to this side. So since the geometry is just rectangular, the electric potential is just increasing linearly. And what I've shown here is the U2 component of displacement. And you can see along the grain boundary, I have a jump here. What I'm showing in this picture is this final G function here. So that, remember, G is U plus minus U minus for this geometry. So the difference in G, the size of this jump in displacement across the grain boundary, is what I'm plotting as a function of time. And then this is the sigma 2-2 component of the stress tensor. And it's if you slice that function along here, you get the normal stress eta as a function of time. Okay, so if you collect all the equations that we want, I told you that this is the main evolution equation. The rate of change of g is proportional to the second derivative with respect to arc length of the normal stress eta plus the electromigration term here. And this came from the flux being equal to the gradient of eta plus psi on the grain boundary. The other conditions are either definitions or they are flux boundary conditions at junctions. So basically mass is conserved at junctions as well. So you have to enforce this by saying that this says that chemical potential continuity has to occur at these junctions. Yes. Yeah. So actually, the way I do a more an Eulerian picture of the grain boundary network. So I'm letting the reference configure or the natural state of the grains evolve in time, and I'm looking at how did I have to so if you had a deformation phi, instead of defining it to be instead of defining displacement to be phi of x minus x, I do x minus phi inverse of x. But basically, the grains are staying put. I'm assuming that the atoms are incorporating to either side of the grain boundary as a function of time, and I'm looking at how the reference configuration or the natural state of the grains has changed in time. Okay, so a couple of comments. So this is a linearization of a more complicated model. If you do put curvature-driven grain boundary motion into the equations, then you would want to figure out what fraction of the atoms are going to the left side of the grain boundary, what fraction are going to the right side, and then you could have your grains vanish and disappear and do some of the things that you were showing in your talk. But just as a start, this is what we're doing. So I should say that these equations are very stiff. First, you start with the displacement field, you compute the stress, and then you take two derivatives of it to figure out what the evolution is in time. Also, they're non-local. Because we're solving the elasticity equations, if you separate the grains over here, that actually causes stresses everywhere else. So it's a very non-local set of equations. There are issues of boundary conditions, like I think you were mentioning in one of the other talks. Normally you need two boundary conditions for this fourth order equation, one for the heat equation, and we're sort of in between. We've got, first we take a first we compute stresses, and then we take two derivatives. So it's a little bit unclear at first whether you should have one boundary condition on displacement or whether it's okay to specify both. And actually, Len, Jamie, and I jumped back and forth on this for at least 2 months, deciding whether or not we had over-specified it or not. The other thing that makes this difficult is that at the very junctions where we want to be specifying these boundary conditions, singularities occur in the stress field. So does it even make sense to talk about boundary conditions on normal stress if components of the stress tensor are diverging at that point? It turns out it does make sense, and I'll try to explain that in this talk. And then we also want to make use of the fact that we've linearized the model, that we are we're modeling functions, this jump in displacement g along the grain boundary, rather than letting the grain boundary be a moving interface. So maybe we can make use of that in our analysis. So that's the idea. So just to give you an idea of the nature of the diffusion process, I worked out an analytic solution for an infinite interconnect line, which doesn't have the problems of corner singularities or boundary conditions at the end, and it does give some insight. So imagine that you start with a sinusoidal displacement jump g. I used complex variable methods for elasticity to show that the solution, the normal stress eta that comes about from that specified jump in displacement, ends up being proportional to g with the proportionality constant depending on omega, like this. And then you can just use the Fourier transform to superpose all the different modes of the initial condition. What that function c of omega looks like is this. The different graphs or the different plots correspond to different material parameters. Kappa is 3 minus 4 times the Poisson ratio. So kappa equals 1 is incompressible. Kappa equals 3 is the largest value it's allowed to be. And C of omega squared is what actually goes in this time exponential here. And you can see that it is, in fact, halfway in between this heat equation and this four derivatives of x, this linearized surface diffusion equation. So for large omega, C of omega grows linearly in omega. So for large omega, this looks sort of like a Hilbert transform times three derivatives here. And for small omega, it looks like the heat equation. For So just this term is the leading term, and that's just a constant depending on the material parameter there. For aluminum, kappa is 1.6. Okay. So that's promising. It shows at least we have some idea of what's going on along the grain boundaries, but now we have to figure out how to deal with all these boundary conditions. So my idea was, I started to define some operators. I was thinking of this mapping that takes a given displacement jump G and gives you the normal stress as a sort of Dirichlet-Neumann map along the grain boundary. Even though it's a very complicated network, you can still think of it as just a mapping from this function to the corresponding function here that you get by solving the equations of elasticity. And then here we're just taking two derivatives with respect to arc length. So this looks a lot like, or this is, something that we've studied with the Poisson equation or the heat equation. So my thought was that here it's very useful to think about Green's functions and things going the other way. Maybe we can study this operator S by studying its inverse B, which turns out to be, you can write the equations this way, gt equals L, two derivatives, times sg, which is eta plus psi. Or if you apply S to it, then you get an equation just for the evolution of normal stress. So the operator B solves the Lemay equations with interface boundary conditions along the network and zero displacement boundary conditions on the outside. And I sort of discovered that B was self-adjoint numerically and then thought of a proof using the fact that the energy stored in the grains turns out to be equal to this integral of eta b eta. So this turned out to be a really nice result that we didn't anticipate at the beginning. And B is compact because you're taking traces in order to get the jump and displacement across the grain boundary. The operator G is quite a bit easier to analyze. It's basically solving the Poisson equation on the network. The main difficulties being that you have several grain boundary junctions where you have to impose continuity of eta to get continuity of chemical potentials, and also this Fi eta, that's a flux function, the net amount of stuff flowing into a junction. So if you analyze this sort of generalizing what you would do on a unit interval for the Neumann problem, you can show that except that it does have a kernel. If you correct what it does on that kernel, it turns out to be an isomorphism. Okay, L to the minus 1/2 turns out to be an isomorphism from L2 of gamma to H1 of gamma. And that turned out to be useful in the proof of well-posedness as well. So now we're looking at something that looks like eta dot equals SL eta. And I have some handle on these operators S and L that I've done some analysis on. So the idea is maybe we can use semigroup theory to say something about the evolution of this normal stress. These are just the semigroup properties, and then if you satisfy these properties, then it turns out that for everything that's in the domain of SL, you actually have this derivative, or this. It actually satisfies the equation we want it to satisfy, which is the eta dot equals SL eta. So what we actually wanted to solve was eta plus psi here. Turns out if you add psi, what you have to do with the semigroup is put eta 0 plus psi inside of ET and then subtract psi at the end. So what it really boils down to is we need to be able to solve this equation, eta t equals SL eta. If we can do that, then we basically have the solution. Okay, now at the beginning I didn't have all of these, I didn't really know very much about the operators B or G, so this started off as a numerical idea that if we can compute B and G numerically, since they are compact, we can probably hope to model them using finite elements or something. If we can find the eigenfunctions of this operator K, which turns out to have the same eigenfunctions with reciprocal eigenvalues, then we should be able to write down an expansion like this for the semigroup operator E. So that was the idea. The analysis that I did later, you can show that these phi k's, which are the eigenfunctions of k, are equivalent to an orthonormal basis for H1 of gamma. and you can prove that this semigroup ET is analytic, which is important for boundary conditions. So if ET is analytic, it means that it maps the range, or it maps the space H1 of gamma into the domain of the generator of the semigroup. And everything in that domain does satisfy the boundary conditions. So, for example, that means as soon as you turn on the electron migration, although the electric field does not satisfy flux boundary conditions at these junctions, as soon as you turn the process on, immediately the stresses locally there will rearrange themselves in order to get a balance of flux. So this was nice. I mean, there were so many boundary conditions at the beginning. It was kind of nice that the machinery of semigroup theory sort of guarantees that these boundary conditions will be satisfied right away. And then the other thing is you get mass conservation just because in this evolution you're in the range of L, which satisfies this mass conservation formula. Okay, and the other thing that this does is it does tell you that the normal stress, although other components of the stress tensor will blow up, the normal stress itself, which is the one that couples back into the diffusion equation, is remains finite, does not blow up. Okay, so I showed you this picture at the beginning. What I wanted to point out here, so each time we're doubling the time, so this is almost immediate at the beginning here. And you note that, so the boundary conditions you want at this side are that the derivative of eta matches the derivative of, or matches the electric field at this point. And I mentioned that the electric potential is just increasing linearly as you move down the line. So as soon as you turn on the switch, the boundary conditions here, or this function eta immediately satisfies the boundary conditions there, and then it slowly moves on to completely balance the electron migration force. And this is sigma 2,2, and this is tau. Tau, the shear stress actually does have a singularity at the endpoints, even though the restriction of the normal stress along the grain boundary here is perfectly nice. Actually, this has a discontinuity. Sigma 2,2 has a discontinuity here, but its restriction to the grain boundary is well behaved. So do I have like 2 or 3 minutes, 5 minutes? Okay. So these are the eigenfunctions that you get. I wrote this expansion down earlier. So these dual functions are essentially the eigenfunctions that you would get when you evolve G. These are the eigenfunctions that you get when you evolve eta. They more or less look like sines and cosines. Each one is more and more oscillatory. They all satisfy zero flux boundary conditions at the ends here. And so to figure out the coefficient that you get on, say, on the third eigenfunction here, you integrate your function against the third one over here. This is the dual function. So the inner product of phi k with phi star j is going to be delta ij. The numerical method, so like I mentioned before, the idea was that if we can get a hold on this Neumann de Dirichlet map B, and also this the inverse of the, or basically solve the Poisson problem to get G, if we can write down that operator and approximate it somehow on the grain boundary, then we should be able to compute these functions phi k in the expansions. So the idea for computing B, I built on methods by this fossils methods by Tom Manteuffel, Steve McCormick, and Marcus Behrens. The X is I'm adjoining singularities at these junctions because you can compute them a priori, following work by Dodge and Costable. And to compute G, I'll just use one-dimensional Galerkin finite elements on the grain boundary, with some modifications due to the singular functions. And then the idea is just to compute these eigenvalues and eigenfunctions and use them to represent the evolution. So here's a picture. Each of these triple junctions and these junctions where the grain boundary meets the wall has several singular, the asymptotic expansion of it has several functions which are all singular there. So I've adjoined, I think in this corner I've adjoined 7 different singular functions, and All in all, there were 101 here that I did. So n is the number of degrees of freedom that affects a particular node in the finite element mesh. Each of these singular functions is a fairly complicated thing. It has six components. These top two are displacement components. They have jumps along the grain boundaries here. These three are stress components, and then this one is a rotation. And in the incompressible limit, this thing becomes the vorticity for the Stokes equations. And the exponents that you get, so I didn't mention, but the behavior is generally that you're going to have some, each component's going to look like r to the lambda times some phi of theta. And there are coefficients depending on, basically the stresses and have lambda minus one, and the other, and the displacements just have lambda for the power on r. And the exponents can be complex, so each of these circles is, each of these places a red line intersects a green line is a singularity exponent. And more importantly, they can cluster together, so there are four singular lambdas there. And when that happens, the singular functions can be somewhat linearly dependent, so you have to do something to stabilize them. This is what they look like when you intersect with one of the grain boundaries. So these, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 at this junction. And then when you're solving the Poisson problem, you have to incorporate these singularities into the one-dimensional Poisson problem. Okay, so here's a more complicated geometry. What I'm showing at the top here is the evolution along this segment of the jump in displacements here and the normal stress eta. And this is the trace of the stress tensor. It's like the negative of the pressure. So generally, as the material has been moved from this end of the line over to this end of the line, the stress tensor becomes compressive over here and in tension over here, just as a general feature. And then this is the maximum shear stress. And you can see there are singularities at each of these corners. And they are here too, but they're smaller, so you they're actually not large enough to be seen when you're plotting the values on a finite element mesh. And then this was a network that has two connected components. So this operator L has a kernel of dimension 2 now. And this is starting to look more like a real interconnect line, where you have lots of grains all coupled together, and you want to understand what kind of stresses develop and how big will the displacements be and that sort of thing at equilibrium. And then the last thing, it turns out, so I've shown you how I showed you how eta evolves as a function of time. It turns out to get the displacement jump, it's a little bit more complicated because psi is actually sort of in between the operators, sg plus psi. It turns out that in very strange circumstances, there can be certain growth modes that just keep growing. And the picture looks something like continental drift and plate tectonics, where you just have these grains that just continue to move. They don't lead to stresses. They don't really cause any damage. But it was sort of an interesting thing that came out of the analysis that they can exist. And the characterization of what these grains would look like has to do with, you can use counting arguments on the junctions and things to show that non-convex grains and too many quadruple or higher order junctions are sort of responsible for this this type of behavior. And so, and then I also checked that typical grain boundaries are non-degenerate. Okay, so to summarize, I found an exact solution for the infinite interconnect line, recast the problem on a finite geometry as an ODE on a Hilbert space to take advantage of the linearization of the model. I developed a machinery for computing the eigenfunctions of the generator of the semigroup, explored the problem numerically, improved while posing this rigorously. So one thing that did come out of this, I think, is that stress components that are directly involved in the transport process do remain bounded. But this shows that other stress components, hidden stress components that aren't actually coupled to the system, can become very large due to singularities. And most stress generation models that you'd find in the literature use some sort of effective stress that's a scalar instead of the full stress tensor, and this sort of thing couldn't come out of that kind of analysis. And these things might be responsible for voiding or other damage in the line that isn't actually part of my model, that perhaps could be used in some more complicated model. And then I was working on numerical methods. So the things to do would be to sort of put voids back in, figure out how do voids interact with grain boundaries, and also to put curvature driving force on the motion of grains, or on the motion of the grain boundaries. Okay, thanks.